Hello and welcome to Q&A Quest episode 317. I'm your host, Mike Epps, aka Wheels.
And with That's me is not the right number at all.
It's not?
No.
417. It's episode 417. I am your host.
Expectation failed.
Mike, the Mariners broke our hearts again. Apps with us as always.
The Mariners could never break my heart because I will love them either way. They were Bernie Fanboy Monster.
That's true.
And this is Smokin' Joe Gamer, who used to be a huge Yankees fan and now doesn't care about baseball at all.
Boo! Get off the stage.
I would like to bring up that the HTTP 417 error is expectation failed.
Oh my fucking god. Jesus Christ. Oh. Well, I guess the good thing is they didn't lose to the Yankees, so we now will be rooting for their opponents against the Dodgers. Because fuck the Dodgers.
They would fucking die if they lost to the fucking Yankees again, but I don't know if the Yankees have been good in years at this point.
They've kind of been meh since 2004. They did win a World Series in 2009, but it's kind of just been
those guys.
They make the playoffs a lot and do nothing.
Like Patriots fans, fuck those guys.
Harsh. Look at Blue Jays.
If the Birds win it all, at least it feels more like being the runner-up.
Yes. Unlike 2003, where the Red Sox lost to the Yankees in that heartbreaking game, and then the Yankees just failed against the fucking Florida Marlins.
Birds.
So then it just felt like, well, we could have beat them. What the fuck?
Transitive property says we should have won.
Yes. So that's what you got to hope for. Next year, you're back in it. And you have a 2004, maybe with less drama.
Listen, I'm going to be real with you. Like the general like tenor of how things go for the M's means that like next year there will be a total team collapse.
You got to think positive.
Oh, I'm thinking positive. I'm just saying, like, I hoping for the best but expecting the worst.
That's fair.
Yeah. Speaking of things that aren't the worst,
Pokemon
Legends DA.
I think it's a great game.
I've been having a great time.
I've been seeing positive comments from people who did play it and horrible comments from people who didn't even play it at all.
This is very common with video games, actually.
Yes, I'm noticing that. Wow. People hate games they haven't even played. What the hell?
People proceed to hate games as a way of justifying the fact that they didn't play them instead of doing normal things with their lives. So what's everyone's rank so far?
W.
Oh, I'm only Y still, because I've just been... I really just want to play it on stream for RP Gamer.
Yeah, I
don't want to get burned out. Yeah.
I got the next challenge ticket up and coming. Something that did not occur to me that happens as you get further in, but I just didn't notice, is more wild zones just pop up as you advance in rank.
That's cool.
So if it seems like the current set of wild zones seems a little sparse, that is because there are more of them to appear.
Cool.
But yeah, I think my favorite ill-founded complaint about this has been, like, Pokemon games never change. This is one of the most weird, daffy Pokemon games so far. For those who have not been keeping up, Legends ZA is, of course, a sequel to Legends Arceus. There's not a time travel plot in this one so far, but in this one... you're running around Lumiose City, aka Pokeparis.
Yep.
And at night, because the game has a real-time day-night cycle, by real-time I mean it advances as you play, not literally keyed to the clock like gold and silver, but you know, it advances as you play, and the day-night cycle is at night there is the battle zone
where yes.
That is a random part of the city is declared the battle zone, and you enter it and can battle a bunch of trainers. You start at rank Z. You are trying to build to rank A. There is, of course, other things going on. Like, I just got to Mega Evolution. Like, I got my first Mega Evolution. But, like, the entire way that that works has had to change because this is a Pokemon game with fully real-time combat. Your moves have had to... The way moves work has been completely rebalanced. They don't have PP anymore. They have a recharge timer. So, like, a move now has another axis of how they can balance it. Several more, actually, because since Pokemon can move around, if a for a move to hit, it actually has to touch the other Pokemon. So they can have different ranges. They take different amounts of time to recharge. And they have different radiuses of effect. So things like Fire Spin or whatever, they don't prevent the enemy from moving, but if you can keep them in that radius, they're going to keep taking damage basically continuously. You get... it just completely changes how combat works, but it also means that the Mega Evolution gimmick works very differently. In Gen 6, with traditional turn-based battles, the way they had to balance it was... Well, you can only have one Pokemon Mega Evolve per combat. And now it's this more dynamic thing where if you build a meter, and then when the meter's full, you can have, if your Pokemon is capable of Mega Evolving and it has the right, like, Mega Stone, it can Mega Evolve, but that's a temporary power-up. It's not going to be that way for the entire rest of the fight. So you could... You know, if a fight went long enough, you could actually Mega Evolve multiple Pokemon, which is interesting. It's very different. But yeah, like the combat has. If you ever wanted Pokemon to just have very different combat, this is very different. It's still, because each move is working on an individual timer, you can get away with a lot of very different and interesting the balance, the feel, it's completely different. It still isn't like a pure action RPG. Like, you are still like in terms of how it functions, it's very unique, but it's really cool. Like, I've just been having a ball with it because it's such a different idea, and I appreciate that the Legends games give them that excuse to, like, monkey around with something as fundamental as just how combat works.
Yeah.
It's really good. And, you know, it's got really pleasing art design, as Pokemon tends to. It's got, on Switch 2, it runs at a rock-solid 60 FPS.
It really takes advantage of the new hardware, I'd say. Yeah.
It looks really nice, but apparently, like, you know, and I've looked at some footage of it, like, you know, it's going to look worse, but on Switch 1, it does not run badly. It runs at a solid 30 on Switch 1, so.
Nice. Yeah, good.
But yeah, it's really cool. Like, it's a really interesting, like, the Legends games are always sort of the kinds of spinoffs I wanted Pokemon to have back in the day, where, like, they would do something really experimental. And ZA is really good. Like, you know, it's a very different game from Arceus. Arceus was kind of like something that feels like it grew out of Go, where, like, it was built around capturing mechanics. This has somewhat simplified the capturing mechanics to hone in on, like, reworking the battle mechanics. But they're both really interesting and really good. I would say I like ZA a little better. But ultimately, like, this is the kind of game that I'm glad Game Freak is doing with the franchise, where they're making these very, like, they're still using all of the old school Pokemon. Like they're using all of that accreted ideas and concepts, but they're rethinking the gameplay that ties them all together. The Lumios has like this really nice verticality about it. You can, you know, there's all sorts of like little hidden nooks and crannies, and like you can go up and down, and there's little platforming puzzles. It's a really neat game. I've been having a ball with it.
Yeah, I was just gonna say about the combat. I like how, you know, every move has a cooldown, and so you use tackle. And then instead of just waiting for your next turn, then it's like, okay, well, now I can use Leer. Now I can use Growl. So in old Pokemon games, my strategy was usually, well, I'm just like early in the game, I'm just going to keep using Tackle, you know, and they'll eventually just die and that's it. But with this, it's like, it's more strategic. It's like, oh, wait a minute. I use Tackle, but while I'm waiting for the cooldown, let me use Tail Whip or whatever. So that's the thing. There's no...
Yeah, or like you might do that the other way, just by like those debuff moves have a little more utility in a normal fight, just because you're not sacrificing your only move to do
buff. Opportunity cost anymore. Now you can actually kind of do everything.
I was gonna say those debuff moves, it felt like were never that useful, like in just the main playthrough of a Pokemon game.
And yeah, like a single player playthrough of Pokemon was never going to use those.
Yeah,
yeah.
Like they had their certain, like the really good ones, like Swords Dance, had their uses in competitive. I would be very curious what a competitive ZA fight looks like, because it's going to be wildly different from any other Pokemon ever.
Yeah,
but yeah, those had their uses. Game, there's basically never anything that encouraged their use terribly well. This whole system makes it very different. The other thing that I've appreciated over the past few generations, and this includes the Legends games, is that they've kind of started treating moves like they're equips instead of like commands. So like, you know, if I'm going into a fight where I have an idea of what the opponent is going to use, it's very easy for me to swap out this any given Pokemon's moveset to better suit that, because like if you've learned something from a TM, it just sits in that Pokemon's list of moves that it can equip to one of its four slots.
Yeah, and also the TMs are unlimited use as well.
Yeah, they've waffled back and forth on whether TMs should be unlimited use, and they're back to being unlimited use. But yeah, just being able to change moves is really nice. It makes it much easier to customize your Pokemon for whatever you're going to actually be doing. Yeah, it's just really good. And yeah, you'll now get on the, alongside the power and what kind of move it is, you'll now also get a cooldown timer. So like a really strong move can be balanced by just having a really long cooldown timer.
Yeah.
But that'll have a different meaning than, you know, like, you know, it gives them another vector for how to balance a move. It's like, well, how long do they have to wait before they can use it again? And of course, if you're fighting another trainer, if your move knocks them out, all of your moves immediately reset their cooldowns. So that gives you another thing to be thinking about. It's really good. And it's just fun to wander around. Like, there's a lot of weird side quests in this one. Like... and some of the background dialogue you can spot is just fucking deranged.
You've seen lots of that around Blue Sky.
Yeah, yeah. Some of them are saying, some of these dudes in the background, they're saying some weird shit.
Well, there's that one dude, he's like, I just want to smell Pokemon.
That dude, I saw, one of the ones that I saw floating around Blue Sky was like this old guy just saying, go where you want, die where you must. And it's just, excuse me.
Well, I love just the beginning of the game. As soon as you get off the bus, like a Pokemon steals your luggage.
My favorite dumb thing that a Pokemon has done, and there's like some really good stuff in this one where like the side quests are written where it's just sort of like, oh yeah, some of these are really stupid animals. So, like, right as you unlock side quests, you unlock the ability, like, the three of the earliest side quests you'll get are getting you the Kalos starters, like the getting you Chespin, Froakie, and Fennekin. And I love the quest where you get Fennekin because it is someone standing next to a taxi saying, like, yeah, this fucking dipshit is trying to pick a fight with the taxi like it's a Pokemon. Can you, like, fight him and tire him out? And, like, eventually after, like, multiple battles to tire this Chespin out, it's just like the person is just like, see, wasn't that more fun than trying to fight the taxi? That is not a fight that will end well for either of us. But yeah, wasn't that more fun than trying to fight the taxi? You seem like you made a bond with this trainer. You should, and so that's their excuse for giving you the Chespin. But it's just very funny to me that, like, yeah, sometimes they're just really stupid animals. And, like, if you ever had a pet, like, animals will do things for no reason.
Yep.
Let's see. Other bits of dialogue I haven't seen, but I've seen people posting on Blue Sky. Someone telling their crocodile in French, the ends justify the means.
Ooh.
And someone telling a Venusaur, it's best to overdo things, just a little bit.
Venusaur. Yeah, no, I'd love how you just have these, like, roaming gangs of Pokemon trainers at night, and they just, it's like, they're not mugging you, but you know what I mean? That's what it just made me think of. It's like, wow, it's not safe to go out at night in this game.
Yeah, it's a really strange game, and yeah, you get some, like, almost Yakuza light sub quests. I saw someone describe the game as a Yakuza like because it's a relatively small, dense open space with deranged side quests. And there's an argument to be made there.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. But, yeah, it's like the map is big but not too big. You know, you're just in this one city, and you got your wild zones, your battle zones. I like how those are separate because in the old games, you know, there are plenty of times where you're trying to catch wild Pokemon and these trainers are just, you know, trying to kick your ass.
Yeah, like it's very, like, if you're in a wild zone, you're going to find wild Pokemon. If you're in a battle zone, you're going to find, you know, like, trainer battles. And you very much can select into what you are intent, what suits your purposes at the time.
Yes.
The map from end to end is not enormous, but again, I would describe it as dense. There's a lot of stuff that it's very easy to, you'll run past a place a few times without realizing how many little weird branches that it has. It's a really neat, it's a neat and interesting map that, instead of going for sheer breadth, goes for, like, again, that sort of, those sorts of interesting connections that you'll find, again, in sort of a, like, a Dragon game, you have these small open worlds that have a lot of, like, weird nooks and crannies and densities that you would not have immediately spotted.
Yeah.
I'm really excited.
Yeah, when Sword and Shield introduced, you know, the wild area, it was like, oh, that's neat, just a big open area where I can just explore at my leisure and just catch wild Pokemon. And then I got Arceus, and I actually didn't like that one that much because to me it kind of was structured more like a Monster Hunter game. And so now it's like, okay, well, now we've got several of these very large open regions to explore. I'm like, that's good, but they felt kind of empty. They didn't really put a lot of stuff in there. And
yeah, that was all about catching. Like, that was really Arceus' bread and butter. It was about catching.
And go collect some acorns to make your own Pokeballs. And the thing is, you only had the one town, and you didn't have any gyms, and you always had to go back to the town if you wanted to switch to a different region. And it's like, I don't know. So Arceus just didn't really click with me. So then when Scarlet and Violet came out, it was like, okay, well, now, guess what? Here's a massive open world, totally seamless, interconnected. And it's like, yeah, this is the Pokemon game I always wanted. This is great. But what I like about Legend ZA is, like, okay, well, now we're just going to give you a smaller map, but it, but like you said, they really just crammed so much stuff in there. You know, Scarlet and Violet had a huge map, but it didn't feel empty to me because you had the gyms, you had the Titan Pokemon, you had the Team Rocket equivalent camps to go to.
Yeah.
But there's just
there's plenty of stuff to do.
Yes, and your friends could jump in and you could explore together. So, but to me, like, Legends so far, Legends EA fixes the things I didn't like about Arceus. And I think it's a good compromise between Arceus and the more open world feel of, you know, Sword and Scarlet and all that. So, yeah, and I respect them for trying something different with Arceus, even though it didn't click with me. But ZA is like, okay, well, it's the combat is better, you know, and there's just more stuff
it's
just to do.
Refreshing.
And it's more it about the combat, which is what I like.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, like Arceus definitely had plenty of combat, but it was like a lot of capturing would happen without you ever like even throwing out a Pokemon, because that was a game about catching. One thing I will say that I think is kind of interesting that the Legends games have continued to emphasize is the idea of like you are in control of a trainer, and the Pokemon are designed to mitigate the risk to that trainer's person.
Yes.
Both Legends games have this like notion of you can get like blindsided by a Pokemon and it is out for your blood.
Yes.
you will sometimes run into like something that put the fear of God into me was I was running through a back alley and thought, like, you'll find a lot of Trubbishes running around just near trash cans because that's what a Trubbish is. And then I walk into a back alley and then there is a big old Garbodor.
Ooh.
And that Garbodor is, and it is an alpha Garbodor. So it has like, it's bigger than normal. It has red eyes and it's absolutely trying to kill me. And I'm just immediately running right back out that alleyway because Jesus, I don't need to deal with this right now.
Nice.
Yeah. I walked into a wild area and had two Pikachus just thundershocking me. And I'm like, oh, I need to get a Pokemon out and fight and run. And what do I do? Yeah. It's just a Pikachu, but it's still, yeah, even the cutest Pokemon in the world, it's like, oh, I better be careful.
I do appreciate that, like, you know, one of the things that they've really emphasized throughout the Switch era.
They are wild animals.
Yeah, one of the things I really liked about the Switch era of Pokemon is that they've really tried to, like, you know, they put Pokemon onto the, like, into the overworld, but they didn't do it in a half-assed way. They didn't do it in a way where it's just like, yep, there are symbols to show where the encounters are. It's like, well, no, what does a Pokemon do? Like, what, like, each of the Pokemon have, like, the Pokemon have a, like, they all have this, some sort of behavior that befits them. Like, you will get the ones that are just like, these don't want to deal with anything. They tend to hide away. They tend to, sneak around. You'll find the ones that, like, are territorial. You'll find the ones that are just like assholes. Like, they all, you know, they are, there is always consideration about where you find a Pokemon and what it does. I've just really appreciated that.
You like, cut out just on my end for a second there. Sorry.
Oh, sorry.
I would say, yeah, repeat the last 5 or 10 seconds of,
I heard him.
Oh, you did? Oh, okay. Maybe it was just me.
Yeah, broadly speaking, though, it's just that, like, there is always consideration for what a, like, a Pokemon isn't just placed there because it's like, oh, yeah, there should be Pokemon here. It's like, well, what Pokemon should be here and how should it act?
Mm. Right.
And we've seen that throughout the Switch era. That's been one of the guiding lights of how they do these. And they've done a good job repeatedly. Like, honestly, if I were the one whose relatives were buried in the wild, in what is now a wild zone, just filled with fucking Ghastlies, I would be a little offended, but they didn't ask me. yeah, like, I just appreciate it. Their behavior is always befitting the kind of creature that they are, and it's just a ton of fun. Fantastic. Loving it. Like, I wasn't ashamed to say it then, and I'm not ashamed to say it now. Like, Scarlet was probably my favorite game of 2022.
Mm-hmm. Same here.
And you know, this is Bonanza's already out. Like, there's a few other things that would be about this, but like, this is a ton of fun. Like, I am just, I love this.
I've been talking, I've wasted like 20 minutes just wandering around going to all the fashion shops.
Yes.
Oh yeah, there's infinite fashion that is no part of which is gender locked.
My choice was to make a boy and dress him up like a boy, but you can do whatever you want.
Whatever makes you happy.
The game is fine with that. Just dress him up however you want.
I appreciate it. I appreciate that Pokemon is a game where you can dress your character up however you want, and you will find at least one character that looks like you. It's nice. That's something I like seeing that's something that I appreciate seeing in a game that like millions of children will play.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Just absolutely loving it.
I'm excited for any kid whose first Pokemon is this game.
Mm-hmm. Like, this that's is gonna be a like these last few Pokemon games have been the kind of games that I imagined Pokemon one day becoming when I was playing Pokemon Blue in 1998. Yeah. Oh, also, this is very silly, but I appreciate it because I just saw Wheels fuck this up again. I appreciate that there is a class of NPC that exists to just hand you back Pokeballs that you threw out, that you threw in a nonsensical place, and it's like, well, that didn't hit anything. That could be nice. I'm sure someday someone will accidentally get their Master Ball returned that way.
Oh, God. Yeah.
That'd be cool.
Well, that is straight up what, like, they will give you back whatever Pokeballs you lost, which means, like, if you threw them at something that was not a Pokemon, they didn't catch anything. Like, as long as it didn't hit a Pokemon, the NPC that hands back Pokeballs will hand you back whatever you threw. It's not just, like, you get Pokeballs even if you threw Great Balls. If you threw a Great Ball, you get a Great Ball.
Yeah, and just it's worth mentioning, like you said, if you're actually trying to catch a Pokemon and it just breaks out, then no, you don't get it back, of course.
Yeah. But one thing I also appreciate is that they contrived a way.
Oh shit, Fireman for... is on my channel.
Oh, Fireman's on your channel, that explains the thing. But they contrived a way to like immediately visually indicate you're not supposed to catch this fucking thing. Because if you throw a Pokeball at something too much, it will get angry. And that's your symbol for like, no, you can't catch this right now. So some special encounters where you're not supposed to catch something yet, it will just start with, oh, it's angry. Weird for Pokemon, a $1 billion franchise, took more than 20 years to become what you imagined it to be in 1999. Not really. What I imagined in 1999 was just straight up impossible with the tech that we had.
Especially with that franchise being all on handheld devices.
Yeah, I mean, like, for a very long time, like, you know, in 1999, like, the N64 was what it was coming out on that was the highest level of technology. And, you know, by... It would not leave that, like, general, like, it would not go to, like, it showed up on GameCube a little bit, but those games are weird, and they're made by a company that makes weird things, because it was former Dragon Quest 6 and 7 developers, and it was, you know, it was obviously not the main games, but, yeah, I mean, like, you know, by the same token, when I was, like, playing... you know, Final Fantasy, you know, playing RPGs on like the Super Nintendo, like before I really understood what they were, with like Final Fantasy Mystic Quest, my imagination of what those might look like in the future didn't, like, you know, I imagined them looking like what ended up becoming like Dragon Quest 8 and 11. Those took a very long time to happen. You know, it's there's a lot of questions of time and budget and technology that go into that. So not too terribly surprised that it took that long. And I need to find an Eevee. I have a friend who was talking about how they found one on a rooftop, and I'm like, where is that rooftop? I need to get some Eevees.
I need Eevees.
I need new Eevee evolutions. I want Dragon Eevee.
Dragonion.
Yeah. Drakion. But yeah, like, just one of those things that, like, I think it would be, and honestly, I'll be real with you, I think it would be silly if it had immediately turned into the thing I was imagining, because, I don't know, I guess that would be kind of boring if it didn't do anything, if it just was immediately what I was expecting. like, I'm glad that it turned into the kind of game that I was imagining, where you get these, like, worlds to explore that feel like what existed in my head when I was playing a Game Boy game. But, you know, that's a very abstract concept to begin with. That's not really a game. That's an idea.
Yeah.
I mean, but they've found ways to translate those things. You're fucking... I'm expecting your routes to just get its ass beat, but no, it did a good job.
I really appreciate they gave one of my favorite Pokemon to me right away as a mystery gift.
Yeah.
It was nice.
Yeah, you get the... I think if you buy the game before, like, January and pull down the mystery gift, you get that.
Nice.
So it's just like an early buyer's bonus. You get like a Ralts with a Gardevoirite.
I was gonna say, like, the series for me started to turn to more what I imagined in Sun and Moon, where just as X and Y was pretty, was that early in 3DS? I don't remember.
That's a 2013 3DS game, I believe.
Yeah.
About 2 years in.
But Sun and Moon where it felt like they started making more fully realized worlds. And what should I call it? Sword and Shield is a little step back from that, but then, yeah, Scarlet Violet is where it really, really hit that pretty well. But now I want a Pokemon Legends in Sun and Moon, please.
Well, there was a leak really cool about where the next one is, if you care.
It's not there, is it?
No, it's not in Alola.
Is it in the Black and White region? What's it called?
Nope, it's not in Unova.
Is it in Sword and Shields?
Yeah, that's the leak.
Okay, I'm cool with that, actually.
Now, bear in mind that can change. What we know about Legends EA is that originally it was in Johto.
Okay.
Interesting. So, yeah, like, these do shift around.
I don't care about Johto.
I care about Johto, but...
I do, too.
Allegedly, there's something that will be servicing Gens 1 through 4 in the same set of leaks, so...
I have still never really played Gold or Silver in any form.
Oh. Yeah, they're good. They're very ambitious, but again, allegedly there's something that will be servicing Gens 1 through 4 in those leaks, so perhaps we shall see. But yeah, overall I think that the franchise is in a creatively very healthy place. Mm. It feels like the Game Freak has a lot of good concepts for where to take it, and I'm looking forward to Gen 10, which we will probably be seeing next year.
Yep,
I would suspect that will be a cross release.
I feel like this is a much healthier place for the side entries to be than where it was. You know, I like the mystery dungeon games for sure, but you look at back at some of the past like spin-off games, and they're all over the map in terms of gameplay and quality.
Yeah, you would like, because back in the day, you would get a Pokemon spinoff, and like it might be really neat, but it also probably doesn't feel like it probably doesn't even feel anything like Pokemon.
Yeah,
like it just has Pokemon in it. Like, I love Pokemon Snap. That's not really neat. That didn't need to be a Pokemon game. No. That's a light gun game. Like that's a light gun game where you're shooting with a camera. Whereas like or like your Pokemon Froze or like Mystery Dungeon or Puzzle League or like any of these, there's Pokemon in it, but it's not really like, or even if you look at like Colosseum and XD Gale of Darkness, I mean, it's a slight twist on Pokemon, but mostly it just feels like Pokemon without any of the, without much of the exploration elements, because they're very, like, you go look at what's actually in Colosseum or XD Gale of Darkness, there's not a lot of game there. Like, there's, like, three main locations in those. there's some interesting gameplay ideas around having a very limited selection of Pokemon that I think could be revisited in interesting ways, but that is, yeah, it was a weird time. Like, or you had the stadium games, which the core appeal of those was, what if a Pokemon was in 3D?
Yes.
And like that was very much an idea with a sell by date. Let's
see. Okay. But then all of the enemy trainers cheat in that game. What? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I remember playing Snap in Stadium, and it was like I was so happy, like, oh, N64 is getting a Pokemon game in 3D, and then it's like, oh.
You would keep, like, every time, like, you would keep seeing people be like, finally, they're making a 3D Pokemon game, and it would not be the game, it would not be a normal RPG. There was always some sort of, there was always something... Yeah. There and like, I love Pokemon Snap, but it was not the 3D Pokemon game that people were begging for on N64.
No, it was not.
And like, you know, you play Stadium and it's like, oh, this is just battling. That's all. I think I'll go play the mini games again. It was fascinating. So a quick one from Fireminer. What is this weird resentment Pokemon fans have that they think Pokemon is a cash cow that allows Nintendo to make less profitable games instead of reinvesting into the franchise? So here's the rub, and this happens with any like major franchise, but especially like anything that resembles a live service, because I see this a lot with like fans of companies that produce MMOs and non-MMOs. Yes, I'm thinking of FF14 right now, but it's not unique. Which is that people see the game that exists bringing in money, and they're like, why isn't all of that money going right back into the game? And the answer is that that's not turning a profit, that's breaking even. and, you know, for the sake of yourself and the future of your company, you can't put all of the money you just made back into the thing that has already been made. Live services or like cash cow franchises in a healthy company exist to finance the things that don't yet make all that money. Like that's just how it should be.
Well, you like, think about it, World of Warcraft was probably used to fund every other Blizzard game after that point.
Yeah, I wish they had made more games, honestly. But
it made Hearthstone.
Yep. It made Heroes of the Swarm. It made StarCraft 2. It made a lot of things. But yeah, like a healthy company is reinvesting those. Like, you know, obviously you don't spend nothing on the existing franchise, but you certainly don't need to spend it all on that. That doesn't make any sense. Something that I've been rolling over in my head a lot is.
Rolling.
Yes. So something I've been rolling over in my head a lot is that We're hardly the only ones who have talked about how games need to be they need to be made cheaper. Like, there needs to be ways to make them cheaper. Ultimately, what Game Freak is doing is making games cheaper.
Yeah.
Like, they have relatively small teams. They work on relatively tight deadlines. They have relatively controlled scopes. They've managed to be very creative over the past 7 years doing that. Like, I'm going to keep saying this. I don't think that Pokemon has ever been in a better place creatively than it has in its for a console generation than it has been on the Switch. There have been a ton of games that, like, even if you don't like all of them, there's something unique about every single Pokemon game on the Switch.
Yeah.
And I think that's worth a lot.
Well, like the Let's Go Pikachu, Let's Go Eevee, yeah, you could see how those were more inspired by Pokemon Go, and like you were saying before, those were games that were also focused on catching as opposed to the other elements.
Yeah, and then what followed was Legends. I'm convinced that Legends came from the Let's Go team kind of continuing to refine the idea of like a catch-based game.
Yeah.
But yeah, like in general,
so Switch got four games that were very different and each had their own strengths, you know, I would say.
Yeah, you have the Let's Go's, you have Sword and Shield, like you have, which is the more traditional, but it has the wild areas. You have Scarlet and Violet, which is much less traditional and has the has kind of a big you know, a complete change to the form. You have the Legends games that take up huge aspects of how the games are structured. I would again argue that the series has never been in a better creative place. Like, I've never been more confident that the next Pokemon game can still surprise me and still be great.
Yeah.
What I would say about this is that, you know, this game that you're looking at is sustainable development. Like, it is, okay, we're reusing huge amounts of assets. We are making something in a scope that is controlled with a team size that has not ballooned, that continues to take interesting creative risks. This is genuinely a much healthier thing to be making, and I think is probably like one of the, you know, because like there, and you know, Game Freak obviously has its own issues, but I honestly think that those sort of came down to having to have Generations out to tie in with the anime so that those could never slip. But you know, the, in terms of like, you know, I've seen people complaining like, but these, like, shouldn't they pour more money into these? Like, they do so well. And it's like, when you pour more money into a game, what are you actually doing? You're hiring people. Like, that's what the money is. It's hiring people and, like, potentially investing in, like, new technology, whatever. But ultimately, that comes down to people. You are spending money to increase the size of the team to make the game bigger. And ultimately, I don't think being bigger is what these need. And I'm kind of glad that they don't seem terribly interested in doing that.
I'll take these every day over another boring Sony sequel.
Like, the reason that a lot of games have sort of turned into either a crossover battle royale or a like mega budget linear action game with some RPG elements, or actually more likely a mega budget open world game with some RPG elements, is that is what, like, when you get that big, that's kind of what you end up making in order to prevent yourself from getting just utterly wrecked. Like, because you need to make something that will hit as many things as possible. And Pokemon, luckily for them, has the luxury of not having to worry about, well, who is this going to appeal to? It has Pokemon and it's going to be able to plant, like, millions of children.
Yeah.
But this does give them the benefit of, we don't have to go big or go home. Like, the Pokemon audience is fine with a game that is not made unsustainably large. And, like, there is a portion of that audience that will get mad, but that audience is going to be mad no matter what. I couldn't tell what people were going to be mad about until the game came out, and then, like, the reviews came out, and then people just sort of decided what they were mad about.
Yeah.
It was surreal.
Doesn't look good enough.
It looks amazing!
So what doesn't look good enough?
Pokemon.
I mean,
people who played the game had nice things to say.
You have seen Pokemon historically, right? I mean, apparently looks not good enough is generally the thing. Unless you're talking about the, like, Mega Starmie.
I love Mega Starmie. It's a horrible creature.
Yes, I'm frightened. I have not seen this yet.
I'm not going to spoil that for you, but okay. It's a horrible creature. I love it.
You know the meme with the two really muscular guys holding hands, like giving a handshake?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And I've seen one where it's like,
that's straight
fans
from the
who
Predator.
Love Pokemon Arceus, fans who hate Pokemon Arceus, shaking hands. Mega Starmie is awful.
It's awful, and that's why I love it.
It's like the one thing that the entire fandom can agree on at this point. It's like, what is going on with this thing?
The thing that they can't agree on is whether it being awful is a parentheses negative or parentheses positive thing. Because I am very much a, Mega Starmie is awful parentheses positive sort of person.
Yeah, I can see that.
I mean,
it's awful in the way a Ed Wood movie is. It's like, seriously, guys, who thought this was a good idea? But ha ha ha, this is ridiculous.
Okay, so we've got another one from Fireminer. It's kind of an interesting question because this is actually a very notable piece of news. Before we get into this, I will bring up Tomonobu Itagaki passed away this past week.
Yeah,
for those not keeping abreast of the news or who have forgotten who this was, Tomonobu Itagaki was the creative lead at Team Ninja from about 1996 to about 2008. So from its inception until Ninja Gaiden 2 on the Xbox 360. He was notoriously outspoken in that space of time. He was always sort of giving interviews in something that was like almost a pro wrestling persona of just like a guy who talked a lot of shit. And like talked about how much he hated Tekken just sort of because he could. Which, as far as I can tell, was mostly a bit. He and Katsuhiro Harada seem to have gotten along quite well. But yeah, so he'd been out of the public eye for many years. He, after that, like, he had been ousted due to allegations of sexual harassment that are quite probably true. I don't want to sugarcoat the man's legacy. But he was ousted from Tecmo around that time, shortly before Ninja Gaiden 2's release on the Xbox 360 in 2008. He would go off to make a team variously known as Valhalla Game Studios, Tokyo Vikings, who tried to work on an incredibly snake-bitten project that eventually turned into The Devil's Third. It was originally to be published by Microsoft. Microsoft dropped it. It was then to be published by THQ. THQ went out of business. There was a Korean studio that was going to publish it at one point. It had to change engines from, I forget what, possibly some sort of internally developed one to Unreal Engine 3 late in its development, and then was ported to the Wii U and came out in 2014 to terrible reviews. And then he never really managed to get another project off the ground. Itagaki, like I said, he passed this about a week, like this past week. I don't know if we have like a public acknowledgement as to what did it. He would have been 58, I believe. He was an old looking.
It might take a while for them to come to an actual conclusion. They try to say something.
I wouldn't be surprised if it is not made public.
If you go and look for pictures of him, you will find that he is smoking in most of them.
Yeah, what I was going to say was he was an old-looking 38 back when Ninja Gaiden came out. And
I mean, he did not lead a healthy lifestyle, so it's more of a case of they need to figure out exactly which of the possible contenders killed him.
But, yeah, it seems like he was well aware that... 3 months
before they say anything publicly.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if they just don't say what it was, but... Because like this would not be the first person, the first old school game designer we have seen die over the past few years of relatively mysterious circumstances. I don't know that anyone ever like came out and said what Rieko Kodama passed from either.
We didn't even know she had passed for like
yeah,
half
it was
a
long time before anyone acknowledged
that
she had passed.
Yeah.
But,
I mean, how long did it take them to publicly state what Toriyama died of? Or did they?
It was a few months.
Yeah. They preferred to be really, really certain of the cause of death before they say anything.
Based on some of the things I've heard about him, I don't think that this was a super unexpected death. I suspect we just probably won't get an explanation.
Yeah.
But, because like he had lined up both like final social media posts and entrusted in like a specific, like you're the person who's going to be my surrogate for English posts about this. So he definitely knew this was coming. Like I said, probably like the smoking probably didn't help. He was not, like I said, back when Ninja Gaiden came out in like 2004, he was not a young looking 37 at that point.
Was anybody a young-looking 37 in the 80s?
Oh, I'm talking about like Ninja Gaiden on the Xbox 04.
Oh, never mind.
But yeah, he was not a young-looking 37 in 04. Like I would suspect that, you know, like a combination of the smoking culture in Japan, the drinking culture in Japan, and especially game dev at the time, the crunch culture at the time. That combination of things does terrible things to your body. You mortgage your youth to, and you know, you oftentimes do not have the reserves to pay for it when you're getting older.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember exactly when they finally pushed the smoking section of the restaurants out of existence. That like it happened sometime in the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Probably before COVID, but COVID definitely gave the death knell to it if it existed afterwards.
Yeah.
Yep.
But, yeah, so... Yeah, just wanted to mark that since it is a very important piece of news one way or the other. And I will bring up something that I brought up on Blue Sky a few weeks ago, apropos of nothing, as I had no idea, like, it was not public that he was in this state, but I'm going to bring up one of the funniest things from Itagaki that I remember. When the Xbox 360 launched, Tomonobu Itagaki was doing a press tour for Dead or Alive 4 and being asked about achievements. He was asked, when they asked him about them, he just said, "What are those?" When told they were required for approval, he just said, "Oh, then they're probably in there, whatever." This was one of the like two big Xbox 360 launch games, and achievements were in their infancy and one of the like big things that Microsoft was pushing, and his response to what he thought about designing them was, "What are those?"
Oh, that's great.
But yeah,
have you guys gone into the museum? And
I have not. I have not. I have no idea where you found
it. It's all the way north of the city. It is, the stuff in here is like this.
Yeah, I'm seeing the Steel Gun.
This is fucking great.
Yeah, I'll have to check that. Okay, so this leads us to the actual question Fireminer had proposed. I want you to think this question
what is did targeted, he ask?
It's targeted at Itagaki specifically, but how would you feel if Konami posthumously credited Kojima in their new MGS, or for Nintendo to do the same with Shouzo Kaga? Well, I don't think there's a risk of that. I could see Konami maybe doing it with MGS. The most I could say... I think the most you could do that would feel respectful would be, like, dedicated to the memory of.
Yeah.
That's not overstating their involvement with the new installment. It's just saying, like, hey, we recognize that there wouldn't be a new installment to make without you. I think that's reasonable. If you start, like, crediting them as, like, a producer or, like, some... like anything that resembles a real title, that seems like you're just kind of trying to leech off their legacy. He brings up WWE fans have been debating for years about whether it's cynical for the company to induct wrestlers into their Hall of Fame that had been treated terribly by WWE in years past, or those who had scandals big enough to force them out of the promotion. Like, I think that there is value in accepting, in like, you know, putting that aside, like, it depends, of course, on how the company carries itself. Like, WWE, it's always like, there's always a greater edge of cynicalness, because when they acknowledge a wrestler who has passed, they are using it for marketing, because, like, ultimately what the company is a group of people. With a creative endeavor, there's something... Well, not that wrestling isn't a creative endeavor, but with a, like, teams of people creating a specific, like, art that does not involve the live faces of humans, there is something to be said for, like, crediting, like, we wouldn't be there, wouldn't be here without you, in that sense. So I think, like, you know, if Kojima were to suddenly pass, I think it would be like, I know Konami would absolutely find some way to credit him in the following, like, Metal Gear project that they had cooking up. But I think that, like, anything more than just, like, you know, a short little, like, you know, in tribute to the, what amounts to in tribute to the person that helped start it all. Anything more than that would feel a little gross, but I think that there's worth in just saying, like, acknowledging that someone was there and that we wouldn't be here without them. There's ways also, you can, I mean, do that.
Like, I'm like, I can imagine something a bit more than that for Akira Toriyama on whatever happens next with Dragon Ball.
Whatever happens next with Dragon Ball, they're going to absolutely pay tribute to him. I think we're about to find out what that might be in January, but because they're talking about the Genki Damashi.
Genki Damashi, okay.
Yep. But that's scheduled for January. If I'm remembering correctly. Let's see. But yeah, so that's so we'll probably see some sort of, like, major tribute to Toriyama going on with that, especially because it will be right around Dragon Ball's 40th anniversary. Yeah. Okay. So some other ones. By the merit of your argument about Game Freak and sustainability developing games, is Hades 2 evolutionary enough from Hades 1, and people giving Supergiant a pass because of their supposed indie label? I'm not a Hades person.
I can answer what
I've seen
questions.
Makes it seem like a fair evolution.
They did all the right things evolving Hades 2 from the first game, and it's all in, like, the guts, and making it a much, much better game. And a much more thoughtful game. Like, when I first started getting the different weapons in the game, I kind of groaned because they all kind of seemed weird. But it actually turned out to be a good thing, because they all play very differently and make you kind of rethink how you're going to do builds and what perks you're going to take. And there's a way more build crafting in this game than there was in the first game, to an extreme degree. And you could tell that from how much I've been playing, and I've used every different weapon and tried every different weapon, and we've tried lots of different perks. And you've probably heard Joe and I talk about how, hey, this seems really terrible. And then it's like, oh, this is extremely broken. What the fuck?
Yeah. We had a few conversations like that. Like, this seems terrible. And then, oh, wait, I was wrong. Wow. Yeah.
But I mean, beyond that, I mean, it's got a much different approach, and there's two different runs, and they do a lot with that and those playing off each other. There's way more dialogue. There's way more characters, and it's a lot bigger, dealing with a lot more of Greek mythology than the first game. So no, I don't think anyone's giving a pass. I think this is
no.
I think the best comparison I would say is this is like the Tears of the Kingdom to Breath of the Wild. Like, they're both extremely good and do different things.
Yeah, this is just a lot more. It's like, it's similar to Hades 1, but just more. Like, I'm playing it right now, actually.
I don't think
I rolled credits on Wednesday, and there's all this post-game stuff to do, too. It's like, they really expanded on the first game. There's more variety of builds. I think there's better systems for improving your character. You know, so.
Yeah, I don't like just saying it's just more, because I feel like it's looking at the first game and finding ways, things that weren't necessarily bad, but ways they can expand on ideas in the first game. Like, I eventually stopped playing the first game, not just because I'd kind of run out of things to unlock, but just because the weapons didn't feel different enough that I'd want to like try all of the, I didn't even unlock all the aspects, as they didn't seem necessary. Whereas this, it's like every new weapon aspect is like, I can find a whole new broken cool build with every single weapon and every single unique aspect.
When you first get the axe, it's like, oh, this is way too slow. And then you get Aspect of Thanatos, and it's like, oh, this is amazing. Yeah.
Well, even if it is slow, like, there's one aspect where you can get where it gets rid of your combo and it's just the one attack.
Yeah.
And I tried, and there's lots of cool things you can do with that. What were you going to say, Dave?
So we keep
shouting over you.
Sorry.
you just interrupted me while telling me not to let me be interrupted. What I was going to say was that for a long time, especially in the big budget space, the notion of a sequel built directly atop its predecessor kind of fell out of fashion. The idea of like, okay, we made a game and we, you know, it was good, but, you know, people liked it, but we kind of want to go back in and take some of the feedback and maybe like rethink certain systems and then make a 2. That, like, it's not that ever completely went away, but it certainly became much less common. Like, especially among AAA games, to justify their budget, it's like, no, we went back and we rebuilt everything from the ground up. And it's like, well, you're not going to reach the best version of that if you aren't able to iterate on what you've made. Like, if you have to spend all your time reinventing the wheel. But reinventing the wheel was how you justified why these games were so goddamn expensive. Ultimately, I think, you know, when you get something like a Hades 1 to 2, like, that's just a normal ass sequel. That is, we took the old game, we kept the parts that worked, we looked at it, and we tried to like sort of rethink how we were approaching it. Like, that's just a sequel. That's normal. I don't get the complaint. Let's see.
Totally agree.
But no, I don't think that there's any like indie thing about that. It's just that like AAA has become hyper focused on catering to the loudest kind of person who gets mad when they've seen an asset before.
Yeah. And I mean, and you, Fire Mario, should know that we don't just say that because it's Indie on here, because we have been
Indie approximately once every 3 minutes. Yes,
we've been taking pot shots at Silk Song all the time.
Even though you like Silk Song.
I do, but not only is it not like the improvement of Hades 2 like I would expect, but you know, it's nice that they spent all that time building this game with a 3-person team, but they also could have given more people jobs and got this game out a lot sooner.
Yeah.
And maybe bringing in some new talent would have made it more interesting.
I'm not really the kind of game that started as DLC.
I'm not really impressed with that approach as I play Silk Song.
Yeah, I haven't played it. Maybe I'll get around to it eventually. Let's see. To tag on to a previous question, look at how WWE treated the Ultimate Warrior like some kind of nutcase, only then to turn around and induct him into the Hall of Fame. Yeah, that's pure like using the name. And also treating him like a nutcase was ironic. It was a broken clock being right twice a day. like any human being who had paid any attention to what the Ultimate Warrior was saying at any given moment was like, oh God, I need to hear less of what this man is saying. Setting some land speed homophobia records. We talked about how there are 5 or 6 artists out there ready to fill in the void for the late Toriyama. I mean, we've talked about how there are people in waiting to try to fill that up. I think Toyotaro is going to ultimately be who they end up settling on. But what about artists who can't be replaced? Like, when I say there are people waiting to fill the void, I'm not saying Toriyama is replaceable. Mm. I'm saying they're going to have to go on without him.
Yeah.
I want to draw that line right there. I'm not saying, like, there are many people who can draw in Toriyama's style, but there aren't other people who have his same instincts. And
also, most of those people are drawing characters he's already designed.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, some of the manga are drawing things that are based on his style, but are their own designs, too.
Mm-hmm. Toyotaro.
Some of the licensed manga artists and writers for Toriyama's spinoffs have a lot of leeway in what they can do. They just have to use the right style of art.
Yeah, that's why I'm bringing up Toyotaro, because he was the one that, like, Toriyama seemed to have entrusted the most, like, design sensibilities to.
Series, in fact, which is a bit. Big thing. We're not talking like one of the side manga.
Yeah, this isn't like a Heroes spinoff or something. But
or Dino Daiboken.
Yeah. But broadly speaking, what I'm getting at there is there are people that fill in that can bring a similar style. They're not replacements. I don't like that phrase, even though But yeah, to continue with the question, who will replace Yoshitaka Amano or Keita Amamiya?
It's possible to replace Amano with anyone, just because.
Yeah, I don't.
I have seen some of his art exhibitions. He's got a lot of stuff out there. You're gonna be lucky to find a worthy heir, and probably somebody who does a completely different style.
Yeah, you won't. There won't be a replacement for any of these iconic artists. I don't think there's a replacement for what they're going to do when Amano is gone. Like, that's going to depend, because he's got a hand in a lot of different things. For Final Fantasy, I wouldn't be surprised if they go for a very different logo style for a little bit. Mm-hmm. Something that makes it clear that they don't think he's replaceable. But the other thing to remember is that, like, Amano is such an expensive artist to hire, mm-hmm. that most of your art direction couldn't come from him anyway, since the 90s.
I mean, even earlier, he made some wonderful character art, he made some beautiful scenes, none of which translated very well to sprite work.
Oftentimes, they were made after the sprite work.
Yes. Oh, so wow. Whereas Toriyama, his designs went directly into the sprite designs most of the time.
Yeah. So when you lose Amano,
is much more indispensable to Dragon Quest than Amano is to Final Fantasy.
Yeah, when we lose Amano, what we're probably going to end up seeing is more like an attempt to be respectful of like the importance of his artistic legacy, but the designs within the game will not really terribly be affected. You're mostly going to notice it in the logo.
Yeah.
Because those are the things he still designs. But yeah, it's more going to be about his artistic legacy, the same way that you see, like, there's a reticence within Square to redesign characters that he had a hand in. Like, they do not like touching those if they can help it. But, yeah, and like, that's ultimately, like, even if you could find someone that could do a passable, passable, like, pastiche or imitation of Amano's style, there wouldn't be much value in doing so, because, you know, our view of the art is affected by our view of the artist. So without Amano behind the art becomes less interesting, even if it's very similar. So to continue this question, with Amamiya in particular, while he was taking a step back from the Garo franchise and let other people direct the franchise, he is still a character designer, and if you know Garo, you know that half its appeal are the heroes and monster designs. I have no idea what Garo does at that point, as someone who has watched a few seasons of it. I think that might be kind of curtains for that franchise when that happens, but maybe I'm just not paying enough attention. I haven't really been keeping up with it over the past 5 or so years. I know that syndicated comic strips are a dead art form, but like, if Bill Watterson passed away tomorrow, is there anyone dumb enough to purchase the rights to Calvin Hobbes from the estate? Calvin Hobbes is Watterson. It's just that auteur. I'm sure someone would try if they could get it to sell. I have no idea what the attitude is.
I would be very surprised if Watterson's estate would ever sell that thing.
Yeah, like, I would hope that his estate would know that, like, selling that would be considered a base treachery.
If you look at other major media estates like that, I mean, the descendants of the creator hold on to that thing for generations just because they know what it's worth.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Tolkiens still have Tolkien estate. The Burroughs estate has been living off Tarzan money for decades. Basically,
Jungle Life. I'm far away from nowhere.
Yeah, I mean, Burroughs was also a special case because he was the first real author to manage to do anything with movie rights, and the studios did not know what they were doing legally speaking. So
yeah, there's some weirdness there.
Nobody has gotten a better deal than the Edgar Rice Burroughs estate for anything involving his work ever. So.
Also, we also finally met the stupid chessman.
But you know, the Watterson estate is never going to let go of that media property.
Yeah. I will say is, in the horrible hypothetical where they somehow did, the answer would be someone would absolutely try to buy it, and that it probably honestly wouldn't do much. Because there's simply not a lot of people who would still, like, you know, there's not a lot of people who are going to still want Calvin Hobbes anything that doesn't involve Bill Watterson. I don't think that there's much of that.
I mean, I can name at least 2 fan sequel comic series, which are pretty unpopular, but most of the fan base that they would be trying to reach with this would immediately see it as much of a betrayal as the estate itself probably would, and it wouldn't get anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's see. We've got another question. You know how people use VPNs to buy cheaper games thanks to Steam's regional pricing? I've been seeing a lot of Southeast Asian and South American artists complaining about people using VPNs. They commission cheaper drawings based on local pricing instead of paying according to the exchange rate and purchasing power. That's gross as shit. If you are, like, commissioning someone... Like, if you're commissioning an individual artist and you're trying to, like... You know, you make the kind of money that, like, an average, you know, U.S. citizen with a job or European, like, if you're making that kind of money and you're trying to, like, oh, I'll just, you know, pay them the local rate. And that's, like, you have the capacity to pay more. Don't be an asshole to, like, independent artists. Fuck you.
Mm. Yeah, exactly.
No, I don't have anything better to say about that. Just fuck off. if people are just unseemly, the extreme coupon people at least make some sense, and they usually buy essential goods, not for commissioning art. Like, I've heard many Malaysian artists saying that they could live a week on just $20. Yeah, like, I know people who have commissioned art from people who live in, like, Southeast Asia, but, like, these people spend hundreds of dollars. What's that?
You're talking to one right now, and it's like, I never argue with the price quote on this.
Like, yeah, for me, it's like, I know at least one other person, and, like, they, I know, spend hundreds of dollars per commission, because, like, that's what makes sense. They are, yeah. You know, if you pay an artist, you want to pay an artist a living wage, like, they're not going to ask, you know, it's not unreasonable for them to give, like, cheaper rates to people who literally cannot pay more. If you are commissioning art, you can pay more. Like, if you live in, like, America and you're commissioning art, you can afford to pay more. Fucking pay more. Pay artists. God damn it. Jesus. This should not be like a difficult question. God damn it. I'm just mad. Like, this, I don't have anything useful to say. I'm just mad.
Stop being so cheap.
Let's see.
And stop settling for too many fingers on one hand.
Stop settling for slop. Get an actual... the flaws introduced by an actual person will be infinitely preferable to the hellish flaws of AI. Let's see. For a bit of
context, with an actual person, you can actually have a conversation on how things are going and what changes might need to be made.
This,
without having
you
to
know, is this what we're looking for? They can... And they can bring their creativity to it as well. That's useful. Collaboration makes better art. Okay. For a bit of context, Hasbro has adopted a strategy of releasing the first version of Transformers toy with some kind of wrong coloring, only then released a color-corrected version of that toy later. The average customer won't notice the defect and just buy what is on the shelves, but collectors will and are thus forced, quote-unquote forced, to double-dip. I know that people falsely accuse Atlas of this strategy, but has there been any game company that has tried to adopt Hasbro's approach? Not that would admit it. I'll put it that way. Not that would admit it. I honestly can't really see, like, anyone, like, given the amount of passion it takes to spend your time making video games, where you are being paid way less than you would if you made, like, business software and worked way harder. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine that there's a lot of places that could bring this off. I think you're just, when you see these flaws, what you're seeing is the result of, you know, crunch and time, like, scope limits and time limits. Like, I think that's ultimately what causes these.
And occasionally the insane oops last minute, how the hell did this happen, oh no situation.
Yeah, but anyone who's ever worked on software has had at least one of
my memory or two or three times to gust.
Like I said, anyone
one of those
who's
it was the localizer's fault that. Once it was the localizer's fault, fair enough.
But yeah, like I said, anyone who's ever worked on software has had at least one of those happen as well.
Sorry, I was looking at something. One of what?
A situation where you, like, are getting ready to ship, and it's like, oh god, what? Oh no, there's something terrible in here.
Oh, yes, many times.
Anyone. who has ever worked on in software has had at least one of those happen. This had to come up. So Dragon Ball FighterZ is getting another character, and it's another goddamn Goku.
Why?
This is Goku Super Saiyan 4 Daima version. For those who did not watch Dragon Ball Daima, well, there's your spoiler. They brought back Super Saiyan 4. But yeah, okay. So bringing that up, given how Dragon Ball FighterZ just got an update, you've got to think if there's ever a new Dragon Ball fighting game, it'd either be a FighterZ or Budokai Tenkaichi and nothing else. God forbid if they ever bring back Budokai or Butoden. For more accuracy in English, like Sparking Zero is another Budokai Tenkaichi game. That's what he's getting at.
Okay.
But yeah,
when does that come out on Switch?
November.
Okay. Okay. Good. There's time.
I've got it on pre-order. We'll have to have at least one big stupid fight. It has some fun what if scenarios. Let's see. Yeah, so that's November 14th.
Joe, do you like Dragon Ball?
No.
What a shame.
Would you prefer the Switch to game key card, or do you want the Switch cart or digital? What's your preference?
For what game? What?
No. That's,
what are you roping me into?
Just answer the question. It's all good.
What are you roping me into?
Nothing, I have Dragon. This fine.
He's threatening to send you Dragon Ball Sparking Zero.
Well, I have Dragon Ball FighterZ on Xbox, but I don't play it because I don't know.
Sparking Zero is not that kind of game.
But I don't care about Dragon Ball.
You don't have to. Would you like to be a super power character flying around punching people?
I'm just going to say no to everything at this point. Okay. I do not want them, Sam. I am. I do not want whatever it is you're trying to offer.
I'm going to bring up. I'm just going to continue. Reading out this question. It'd either be, God forbid, if they ever bring back Budokai or Butoden. Yeah, I don't think we're ever going to see Budokai come back. See Butoden as being used as a name again at some point. They did it once in the early 2010s with Dragon Ball Kai Ultimate Butoden for DS. So I could see that name getting trotted out as a nostalgia play in Japan, at least. It's a name that has like value if you were a child with a Super Nintendo. Although the time to play the nostalgia grab might be slipping away as that audience gets older and older. But I could maybe see Budokai getting the name coming back, if nothing else, simply because it wouldn't be the first time.
It's a good name.
Yeah. But yeah, I would suspect that you're going to see a split between like the fighters type, like hardcore player fighting games, and the sparking type of like, here's just like a big stupid arena fighter, and we've made like a bazillion silly what if scenarios. Like the what if scenarios in Sparking Zero are pretty wild, because they're everything from things that affect nothing, like what if the Ginyu Force was killed in a different order, to like scenarios that cause Frieza to come to Earth, or like Frieza to come to Earth instead of going to Namek, or even just weirder shit, like I think one of the scenarios in the super arcs is like, what if instead of stealing Goku's body for the Goku Black arc, they stole like Gohan's body, and that makes like a completely different arc. That's really fucking weird.
Gohan Black?
So what's that?
Gohan Black?
Yeah, there's a Gohan Black arc in Sparking Zero.
That's neat.
Yeah, like the what if scenarios, like the official fan fiction aspect, really gets them a lot of mileage with the Sparking games, which is why I assume we'll probably keep seeing those. But let's see. Okay, but yeah, I suspect we will probably see another something in the milieu of fighters at some point, although I'm not sure if Arxis itself will have time to make it. last month I asked two questions, both about Square Enix games and their institutional support for quote-unquote normal games as well as gacha games. The announcement of the new Dissidia game, you just have to dig deeper. Which specific branch of Final Fantasy do Square Enix executives support and which they don't? There's definitely some support for Dissidia and FF Tactics. Yeah, I mean, like, there are people that, people within, Square Enix with Paul who care about those. Like, with FF Tactics, the Evil East Chronicles was made, it was directed by, Kazutoyo Maehiro, who was originally a, like, he was part of that original FF Tactics team as an event planner, you know, eventually worked his way up to being, like, creative director on FF16. He's definitely a dude in the company with a fair bit of pull. That ultimately ends up being really important to this kind of thing, like, someone in the company cares about it. Dissidia as a whole, I want to say, that, like, I want to say Nomura has, like, some attachment to Dissidia. Mm-hmm. Like, I couldn't immediately tell you whether he was the one that pitched it, but he's definitely been someone who seems attached to Dissidia as a concept. I want to say Stranger Paradise merged in from at least one other attempted Dissidia pitch. He seems to care about that. Like, having someone in the company who is important enough to get pitches to executives who want something to happen is really important for things happening. that really is the long and short of it. It feels silly, but, like, it really is just, like, you know, there has to be someone who has the clout to make something happen who cares about making it happen. And that's why certain franchises just go away. And, you know, the general thing with a lot of these is, like, you know, these kinds of things keep happening. You know, it's the same reason that Theta Rhythm keeps happening. Like, Theta Rhythm does well, but so does Dissidia, and, you know, you could go a long time between those. But, you know, someone having the clout to make it happen and wanting it to happen really does just affect whether these things happen.
Just look at the effect Kawazu has had on Square Enix over the years.
Yep, Kawazu will, like, the second that Kawazu is gone, that's when I will be worried about Saga.
Mm. Yeah.
But, yeah, internally, like, it's not mind who's championing these ideas. Like, Nomura seems attached to Dissidia. Maehiro, who, you know, again, like, his first work at Square, he seems to have come with Matsuno at Quest when when they went to Square, he seems to have come with him. So he's clearly attached to Ivelisse and FF Tactics. And so, you know, given that he's high up enough in the company to have been like creative director on a mainline FF, he's got enough clout to get games to happen. That's just kind of how it is. Since people are talking about Game Pass, how many subscription services are you on right now? Finally cut my cable last week, and for the first time in 20 years, put up an antenna. The reception was good, and the latency was much lower than streaming or satellite TV. The only missing out on a lot of sports, and I don't even watch much sports anyway. I think currently I'm piggybacking off of Wheels' Switch Online expansion pack.
You're part of the family.
Fun for the whole family.
Wow.
Let's see.
Well, I'm on, I was just going to say, right now I'm on Plus Essential, Game Pass Essential, Switch Online expansion, and I have the Disney Plus Hulu HBO Max bundle, so it's cheap. I'm getting Peacock free through Comcast, and I think that's it. Oh, and Netflix. Yeah.
Yeah, so. I don't have Netflix. The only subscription I have is that same like Disney Plus, Hulu, HBO Max bundle because it got relatively cheap. But that's it for those for me. And I don't have Xbox Live or PSN. I don't really use those systems online that much. But let's see.
I just have an NHK cable bundle that includes Disney.
That's what matters. I was gonna, yeah, I've actually been like getting really, like been getting obsessed with like, maybe I'll just grab some Blu-rays so I don't have to worry about, the things I actually want to be able to, so that I don't have to worry about the things I want to be able to watch disappearing. Let's see. You talked about how TV manufacturers desperately wanted the mid to late aughts to return again. The reality of broadcasting TV is that no channel being broadcasted or streamed at 2K. They are either at 720p or 1080i. The channels advertised as 1080p are actually 1080i with HDR on top of it. It means to me that the lower end of the customer base sees no need to buy a new TV, and the only ones that do are gamers and Blu-ray aficionados. Yeah, like, broadly speaking, there's just not a lot of 4K content. Streaming 4K is like a whole mess of like having to crunch bitrate to hell in order to keep things in order to make things feasible, just because of the amount of data you're having to send. Like, it's just not a feasible amount of data, and gonna be real with you, most people don't really notice much of a difference. There's just not a lot of 4K content. The 4K content, like, there's not a lot of content that I feel the need to have in 4K. There are things that I have on like 4K Blu-rays, and it's stuff like, yeah, I think I probably would be, I do want to see all of the detail in Akira, one of the most expensive animated films ever created. But
I mean, I remember like, one time I bought Spider-Verse on 4K Blu-ray. Could not really tell the difference at all.
Mm-hmm.
It really depends on the content, yeah.
It depends on the content. It depends on how fucking young your eyes are. My eyes suck. But,
that too.
But yeah, like broadly speaking, you know, it took... Eventually, Blu-ray sales started to outpace DVDs, and that was only because no one was buying physical anymore. But, you know, like, I think for the most part, like, unless you've got, like, a real eye for details, like, even Blu-ray quality probably isn't super necessary for you. And then, of course, you'll see that with, like, some of the content they sell. Like, I was... you know, I was thinking in terms of things I might want to have physically, since I don't feel like paying for a subscription just to see these things. I was looking at, like, The Office on DVD, because it's like, oh, I like seeing the... I like rewatching The American Office sometimes. That complete series, $35 on Amazon.
That's nice. A lot of seasons.
Yeah, that's like 9 seasons. That's deranged. And even if I would never watch season 8 again willingly, that's still 8 seasons for $35. But yeah, like, but you know, like, imagine, like, if you will, trying to get that on DVD on Blu-ray, there would be no point because it was originally mastered for like mid-2000s TV. It was never going to look that good. It was shot on cameras that were designed to give the feel of a, you know, like cheap handheld documentary cameras. It's never going to look terribly good. There's not, like, you know, especially that kind of content, like, you know, there's just not a lot, there's not much in it. There's, like, if you're looking at a show that was shot in the 90s or 2000s, it's probably not mastered to anything. There probably isn't materials to remaster it to better quality. And it probably wasn't mastered in great quality to begin with.
I mean, that's one of the reasons why Babylon 5's never been on wide distribution for DVD. It's some of the aspect ratios.
All video toaster's fault.
Yeah, they made the wrong choice when it came to the future of recording media. I think it was.
It was more just that, like, at the time, to add in effects, the most cost effective way to do it was to, you know, you put it on video and then you edit it in video toaster and then that's your final master, and then the other material, like, there's no high definition materials for any of the effects shots in space or whatever. It's the difference between TNG and Deep Space Nine. TNG's got like TNG had like film footage of models floating around that you could do a lot of remastering work on. DS9, they did kind of the same thing. Like, you master it and then you master it to video and then you put some effect shots, you add effects to the video after the fact, and you don't really have high quality materials for any of those space shots. But yeah, you get a lot of those. And like, the other thing is that, you know, especially if you're just watching an old comedy, what are you getting out of that being higher definition? What does HD do for you in that circumstance? And the yeah,
now watch I Love Lucy in high definition.
You probably could, because that was shot on film. But yeah.
Let's watch Seinfeld. It's more realistic than some of things.
Yeah. Speaking of things that were probably not shot on film.
Can see every wrinkle on George's brow in 4K.
I don't know. I'm watching
about how old Jason Alexander was at the time.
Jeez. No, I'm watching the X-Files on Hulu and it looks good. I don't know what quality. It looks like it's been updated to widescreen because I'm not, you know, it's not a square in the middle with the black borders. But I mean, it looks fine. I like it. I don't know.
Okay, so. Okay, when did Seinfeld start? I just need to get this the exact how old was Jason Alexander when Seinfeld started?
Not as old as he looked.
Oh yeah, no, he looked much older than he was. Okay,
how old was he?
I'm getting the exact number. Okay, so Seinfeld started in 1990. So, when Seinfeld started, Jason Alexander was 31 years old.
Wow.
Yikes. Yeah.
He looked like that at 31. Oh, boy.
Yeah, on the bright side, he doesn't really look that much different. It's one of those situations where, like, you get old young, and you just sort of look the same for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
So yeah, he's looked around 40-something, or 45 to 50 for about the last 30 years?
Something like that.
Well, what bugs me is over on, you know how Sony has that Sony Core Pictures app on the PS5 now? Well, You can rent and
buy. I didn't
know
that until now, but I trust you.
Okay. Well, turns out you can rent and buy some 4K movies on there, but they're presented in this weird IMAX format. So it squashes it. So remember when you used to try to watch widescreen movies on a full screen 4x3 TV and you got the black bars on the top and bottom? I hated that shit. Well, Sony, I guess, decided, well, we're going to bring that back. So even on a widescreen 16x9 TV, you have this stupid squashes it in the middle and you have these stupid lines. And it's like, what are you doing? Like, that doesn't look better. You can't tell that it's 4K or whatever. It doesn't matter.
Okay, what is the actual IMAX ratio?
Like, I thought that we switched to widescreen because to fix that problem so that it would display properly without black lines. That's all.
It was to give more. It wasn't about the black lines so much as it was about lining up more with what film aspect ratio is. The traditional aspect ratio for film is different from the IMAX aspect ratio.
Mm-hmm.
The aspect ratio for IMAX is actually relatively tall. At one time it was 1.43:1. It now appears to be 1.9:1.
Yikes.
Which, basically puts it as like a pretty wide. It's a little wider than the 1.85:1 that appears to be standard for like just a normal. A normal theater aspect ratio.
Well, what I want is I just want it to match the screen. That's all.
Yeah, no one makes TVs like that. It would actually probably be kind of hard to do it.
Yeah, I know.
Personally, I'm like as much as rude as it is to say, I'm kind of glad that they would rather give you bars than like fuck with the aspect ratio. I was radicalized by seeing pan and scan DVDs. To go back to this, I do think that the amount of people who care that much about like higher visual fidelity on their home TV is like, you know, once you get past 1080p, the returns diminish quite substantially. But it's a way that it is a way to theoretically produce to create differentiating factors. There's always going to be a push for it. The second that someone starts trying to sell me an 8K TV, I will be out for blood.
Yeah, I don't even want to think about it.
The second that someone tries to make an 8K video game, I'm just going to be like, for whom? Why?
It's for our investors, so we can justify getting more money in.
An attempt to make 8K video games will destroy the industry once and for all.
Yeah, I was thinking,
if anybody in the industry has ever shown a concern about the survival of the industry past the current project.
A few. Like a small, beautiful handful.
Yeah, but they're not the ones trying to make the big projects.
True.
Well, I was thinking that even now there are games that, you know, have low frame rate at 4K, and it's like maybe like we need to work on performance just a little more, especially if they want to start ramming ray tracing and path tracing into everything. The hardware's not there yet to do it at 4K without murdering your frame
but
rate.
But what does it matter if the frame rate's not there? Like, that stuff adds very little. Well, like added all this shit to Spider-Man 2, made it balloon the budget. It doesn't look any better.
Forever be the example, just because we have the internal Insomniac. Did anyone notice?
No. I'm sorry. It does not look any better. It doesn't.
Well, no, my point was that I don't think we're ready to go to 8K anyways.
And I'm just saying it doesn't matter because it's not useful. Mm-hmm. Like all these extra graphical features are not useful at all. Like if they had not added all this stuff to Spider-Man 2 and kept the budget down, they probably could have added more content in it. Maybe we would have had a follow-up sooner. Like what was the point?
Yeah, and
I don't understand.
The fact is that there's a $2,000 graphics card that will still, you know, where you still may have to make concessions for certain games, whether you're lowering your settings or dealing with choppy frame rate or whatever. So, yeah, it's just we've hit a point of diminishing returns, like, absolutely. Like, the game consoles, the graphics cards, yeah, they've gotten prohibitively expensive. Like, we can't go beyond where we are now without things becoming prohibitively expensive, and also it just there's diminishing returns. So yeah, I don't want an AK console. You said, that would absolutely kill the industry.
I mean, just if we step aside for a second and just look at, okay, what are like the game of the year contenders this year? And it's like, okay, you've got multiple Switch 2 games, several indie games, and like the only, I guess, and then what, like Claire Obscure?
Sure,
like
there's nothing
in there that's blowing.
I know for a fact that there are people that are enjoying Ghost of Yote. I'm surprised how little I have heard about that game, but maybe I'm just in the wrong place.
I have seen very little.
I didn't play enough.
Weird. It feels like no one talked about that, and I'm not sure if that's me.
Yeah, I don't think it's just you. I think I saw a few streamers on my list pop up with it for like one day, and then it was gone.
Yeah, it was weird. I'm gonna probably like ping some people that I know who seem like the type to have played that.
Zygarde.
I've mentioned before too, though, that like, so the PS5 Pro, you got to spend $700, and what does that get you? It gets you higher frame rate if you put it on quality mode instead of performance. And it's like, okay, but again, diminishing returns. Like, I think the Switch 2...
I can tell the difference between performance and quality anyway.
Sometimes I can. Depending on the game, there's cases where I switch to performance and I'm like, this looks exactly the same. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes quality and performance is just a toggle switch for ray tracing, which you're only going to see if you're staring at puddles all day.
I love staring at puddles.
Actually, to your point about Spider-Man 2, if I go back and play Spider-Man Remastered and Miles Morales on PS5, like, yeah, I can, if I switch over to the ray tracing mode and I just walk around staring at the puddles in the street, it's like, oh yeah, that's a nice reflection on this tiny little puddle of water, but that's it.
Why was I paying? I'm used to swinging past that without looking at it.
You know, and if you're, well, I mean, you get nicer reflections on the windows of the buildings. It's like,
it's
okay.
Pointless. It's pointless.
And the trade-off is that you're getting 30 FPS instead of 60 in every other scene, even when the ray tracing's not doing anything. It's like, I don't understand. And don't even get me started on path tracing. It's like, okay, that doesn't even look any different. And now my frame rate is 15 or 20. It's like, what the fuck?
It really is a strange set of trade-offs.
So I think the Switch 2 is the best we can get from a handheld console without becoming prohibitively expensive, without murdering your battery life, without it overheating and burning your hands and melting. You know?
I'm going to bring up a post that has immediately become a medic, which was someone getting a ROG Ally X and then having to uninstall Microsoft Office.
Oh, I saw that.
Because it's not a customized version of Windows, so it still has fucking Office on it.
And it's got Copilot.
Of course it does.
So it's just, I don't know. I don't know where we're going. I mean, if the PS6 is $800, I'm not going to be able to buy it.
I have not gotten much use out of my PS5. I'm not getting a PS6 until they can promise me there's something to play on it, because I've made that mistake. Mm-hmm. Okay, so a few more of these. A friend of mine recently shared that she bought a new TV that supported the new ATSC3 standard.
I don't know what that is, and I should know what that is, but I don't.
it's a broadcast thing, like over-the-air television. Like I believe it is the the successor to far enough back you would have the NTSC standard.
Yeah.
I believe ATSC was the is kind of a digital standard, kind of the digital successor to that standard.
Yeah, I don't know. My LG TV has the LG channels, and I think it has to go out to the internet. And all that does is let me watch old episodes of Johnny Carson, but they're constantly stuttering and freezing up, and there's a lot of ads. And
incredible.
My dad still has some kind of antenna thing that he uses, and he just watches whatever's on, which is he watches a bunch of old Clint Eastwood westerns that constantly stutter and pixelate, and he gets mad. And he will not invest money in cable TV or Wi-Fi for his home, and he connects his phone to his 5G in rural Texas, and it's he's a very active guy. He goes on bike rides. He just doesn't spend a lot of time watching TV, but you know, I don't know. I am totally lost in this question and what this even is. I don't get it. I just have internet and I have streaming services, and that's fine. So
imagine if we spent, instead of wasting time on stupid, useless graphic upgrades, just made more interesting games. Like, can you imagine if instead of making my favorite punching bag, Horizon Forbidden West, they had made it a better game instead of wasting the time making it pretty?
Well, that game, at least,
complaining about the high definition. Yeah. Actual skin hair that is, you know, completely normal if you've ever been in close contact with somebody.
It's for normal humans.
Yeah. Well,
what I like is, what I like about that game, that is one of the games that has a 40 FPS mode if you have a 120 hertz screen. And to me, that's a good balance between performance and visuals. But yeah, it seems like a lot of time and effort and money and manpower was put into making that game look good and creating this huge world. And ultimately, I honestly don't think I liked it as much as the first one. I thought they made the combat more difficult, and
I just thought it was boring.
Yeah, I never finished the DLC either. So, I don't know. But then again, LEGO Horizon Adventures, I think, is the best of the three Horizon games. It's the most fun, and I like the art style, and it's the best looking Lego game out there. It looks like I'm playing with real Legos. It's amazing. It's like, man, you have Lego pieces with ray traced reflections. Sure. They all look like they're wet, but it's okay. Oh, man.
Man, that's okay. In a child's mouth. There you go.
Yeah. He also mentioned the Sega Channel, which I really wish I had as a kid because I had the Genesis.
And yeah, we'll get to that in a moment. I just want to finish the question before we get there.
Yeah.
So a friend of mine recently shared that she had bought a new TV that supported the new ATSC3 standard and was able to catch some over-the-air interactive TV channels where you could play Frogger or Pac-Man with your remote. I wasn't there for the Sega Channel, but I still remember those old Hugo games where you played on live broadcasts. It's so strange to see old ideas being recycled into new tech. There was always the dream of interactive television or movies, though that's not surprising. Sega Channel was a fucking weird venture. It's not even the weirdest venture. We didn't get broadcasts to Teleview, which is somehow weirder. but yeah, the Sega Channel, at least you could play Alien Soldier on that. That's worth something. Speaking of antenna, the Master System and some of its clones actually supported broadcasting the video signal through an antenna to your TV. Seems like even back then some people had the urge to not deal with wires. Let me tell you about the wireless Atari 2600 controller.
No.
Oh no.
I think so. How do you feel about the Atari 2700?
I don't think I knew that existed, even though I have a handy dandy hardcover copy of that console guide that tells you about all the consoles. I don't
remember. The 2700 did not actually release.
Oh, okay.
It was intended to release, and it was just going to be, as far as I'm aware, it was basically just going to be a 2600 with the wireless controller that operated via radio signals and required a 9-volt battery.
Jeez.
But yeah, there was definitely a desire for wirelessness. I mean, like, bearing in mind that you could get old VCRs that had remotes wired into them.
Yeah, that's bad.
That was the time. It was the 70s, baby.
I remember a neighbor who had a remote control that was actually cable connected to the machine.
Yeah. Yep, that absolutely existed.
What was I going to say? Oh, I forget. There was something. I'm sorry. No, I got derailed. I forgot what I was going to say.
If you remember, we'll come back to it.
Yeah. I hated the Dreamcast controller. You know why? Because it attaches on the bottom and the wire's kind of short, and I always found it awkward. That controller.
Yeah,
spread the hate. Embrace it.
But also, I'm old enough that when I was a kid, we had the cable box with the dial in the middle, and I had two sisters, and we always fought over whose turn it was to get up and turn the dial to a different channel.
I used to think the PSP was the first handheld to have an antenna peripheral to let you watch TV, but it turns out the GameCube and Turbo Express did it first. Yep, absolutely. There were TV tuners for both of those systems. They were absolutely wretched to watch television on. Those portable LCDs were ghost city. Good luck. But, you know, it was kind of neat that you could. How many people you knew back then had a normal handheld TV? None. Zero. Never met a single human being that had that.
No. There was it was like he was saying about, like, the Laserdisc players. It's like, yeah, there was technology 20, 30 years ago that was only available to, you know, wealthy households, and we didn't get it, you know?
Mostly so that they could brag about it.
Yeah. It's like somebody had told me once that typically what's available now to the average consumer, middle class, working class person was available 30 years ago to the ultra wealthy and the military, you know? So
the first, like, experiments with HD broadcasts come from, like, 1992. You could kind of get HD TVs in, like, 1994. They were very strange. They operated on strange principles. But yeah.
And he mentions old packets coming back. Yeah. So what I was going to say about that is I watched a whole YouTube video of a guy. He seemed like a cool guy. He, you know, refers to himself as a total sicko because he went totally out of his way to get, like, a big widescreen CRT TV. I'm like, oh, I didn't know they had those. And then he was, you know, using it to play, I don't know, either GameCube or Wii U or something. No, he was I think he was trying to play Switch on there. So he was trying to play new consoles on this old ass widescreen CRT TV.
Yeah, you probably need a digital to analog converter.
He mentions how he had to, like, lug it up the stairs, and he paid a lot of money for it from whoever was selling it. But he's like, why would you do this? Well, because I'm a sicko. And I'm like, well, hey, you know what? Whatever. If that's if that's your vice, then whatever. There are worse things.
My family's first HDTV was a CRT, and that thing was like 200 pounds. It was absolutely wretched to move it anywhere. There's a genre of YouTube videos that's all about living on old tech, but many times the old gadgets they show were luxury items that most people back then wouldn't have access to. Just look at Laserdisc players or HD quality projection TV. Yeah, like, we got a CRT HD TV because the store was trying to get rid of them and they were cheap by that point. because they were expensive and large, and no one wanted a enormous 200-pound TV. LaserDisc was expensive. It was much more expensive than getting it was much more expensive than VHS. For the same reason, ultimately formats that are cheaper and get you something that gets you most of what you want tend to win out over things that are more expensive and get you the highest quality version of it. Like, that's why, you know, DVD takes over. That's why it's hard to get Blu-ray to dislodge DVD. That's why the thing that dislodges DVD is streaming. Like, streaming in 2008 doesn't look anywhere near as good as Blu-ray. Doesn't matter. No one cares. It's just down to these are the things that people can actually use. So, you know, people want the content. Sony Walkman.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the original Sony Walkman, they tried to make deals with American companies for distribution or production, and they couldn't because everyone thought, oh, the sound quality is crap.
Yep. See, also, like, the assumption that, like, Beta 1's higher video quality would lead to it prevailing over VHS, when mostly what people wanted was something that would have enough storage time, even if it looked bad, to store an entire, like, movie or football game.
Yep.
Like, ultimately, these kinds of concerns will win out over quality basically every time.
Back in the day, you had, when I was in college, you had that. You had these compressed DVDs that were only, 700 megabytes, so they could fit on a CDR and you could, burn them to a disc. So we did that. We watched. Like, I still have some videos on my computer that are, like, atrocious quality, but they're good movies, and I don't have to pay for them, so.
Yeah. Fine. You saw video CDs continue to be pervasive in certain parts of Asia for many, many years because, that was affordable. That was something that you could, even if it wasn't going to be, even if it wasn't going to look great, it was what you could afford, and it got you if you wanted to watch a movie, you could certainly watch it on video CD up into the 2010s if you really had to.
And quite possibly getting the hardware to watch anything better would cost you way more.
Yeah, so it's just like, the thing that does what you need it to do is going to be vastly more successful than the thing that does it the very best, because the thing that does it the very best is expensive.
Yeah, and the top-selling game consoles have typically not been the most powerful. They've been the cheapest. The PS2, the Wii, the Switch,
So. Yeah, a combination of the cheapest and the thing that, meets you at your, level of commitment. The Switch is a combination of being cheaper than its competition, but it's also a situation where it was, this was something that allowed you to play games as you had time for them rather than making games an appointment concept. Those are the two things. You need to meet the user where they are, and you need to not price them out of it, which is part of meeting them where they are.
So PS2 was cheaper and less powerful than GameCube and the original Xbox, but
it was actually more expensive than GameCube, but it came with a DVD player, which gave it a lot of additional, it was cheaper than getting a game system and a DVD player.
Yeah, exactly. And then it also had so many good exclusive games and, your JRPGs and stuff. And then, so for me, I got the PS3 after they dropped the price and started selling the 40-gigabyte model that didn't have PS2 backwards compatibility. And I bought it from Best Buy, and it came with an offer for 6 free Blu-ray discs. I'm like, okay. And they weren't very good movies, but they were free. And it was like, wait a minute, if I buy the PS3, I don't have to buy a Blu-ray player. And to me, that was a huge selling point over the Wii and the Xbox 360. And it turns out there are a lot of people who told me, oh, yeah, I love my Blu-ray player, but when I want to actually play games, then I turn on my Xbox. So,
yeah, like the other problem that, ran into was that like Blu-ray players came down in price much faster than the PS3 itself did.
Yeah, that too.
And of course, just the Blu-ray ultimately ended up running afoul of the same principle. Like, it was not better enough to get people to switch. That does remind me that I'm now just like looking up Blu-rays that I would want to actually own. It's like, oh, hey, the Man with No Name trilogy for $30. Yeah, maybe I will get that.
Well, one of the first Blu-rays I bought, I spent $30 on a copy of Meet the Robinsons, and I just thought it looked great. I thought all the Pixar movies looked great in Blu-ray. You know, like I got the Finding Nemo collector's edition thingamabob. And but as you said, though, I have this whole collection of Blu-rays, 4K Blu-rays, and I never watch them because it's just so much more convenient to watch Netflix and everything else, even if the quality is a little bit lower. It's
oh, damn, they're doing a 4K transfer of Hard Boiled. Sorry,
I had the 4K copy of, no, hold on. I remember getting a Blu-ray copy of Full Metal Jacket, and I'm like, this looks exactly the same.
Oh, fuck.
What?
This shark Pokemon just jumped left out of the water.
No, holy shit.
Alpha. Holy shit.
They're all jumping out of the water. You're fucked, buddy. What? They're chasing you over the land. What are they, Jeff the Land Shark?
Nope. Peace now.
Seriously, catch one and nickname it Jeff.
I will come back and do that when I'm higher level.
Jeez. Oh yeah, and I almost got complete like party wiped by a freaking Swirlix that wouldn't stay in the goddamn Pokeball. Yeah.
Now that we've talked about all the TV stuff, Fireminer had said to skip the TV questions and talk about his Ghost of Yotai question.
Of course you did. You didn't tell me that until now.
Well, you guys were so deep in conversation, and I just let it fly.
Okay, go for your take question. That's probably where we'll end because my throat is starting to give out.
Yeah, so
okay. I tried Yote. I'm really into Ghost One, so maybe not the most objective person on it, but it's extremely good. I believe that. This feels like, you know, an actually living world, unlike a lot of AAA open world games, Tears of the Kingdom included. Tears of the Kingdom's not really meant to feel living, I think. But that depends on what we're describing as living. There's a lot of differences there, but I think like I haven't tried Yote because I kind of found Tsushima immensely disappointing.
I barely played it. Yeah,
I played it's a not, fair bit of it.
Not that I didn't like it, but it's just didn't click with me at the time. And you know, yeah, maybe I'll get Ghost of Yotai when it's on sale for $20 if I ever finish Tsushima.
Yeah, I didn't hate Tsushima. What I did play, like, Sucker Punch is probably my favorite of Sony's like internal developers of that type, and so I kind of wanted to like it more than I did. The other issue I had with Tsushima was that, and you're getting menaced by the Sableye. but the other thing that I felt while playing Tsushima was that, like, I just could not invest myself in that story. Like, I felt like I immediately knew where it was going, and then eventually I got spoiled on it. And I did, in fact, know immediately where it was going. And, like, for all of the trouble they went to in making the environment feel right, the attitudes of how dialogue was brought across felt like it just totally betrayed everything that was all the work that they had put into making the world feel real, because the characters were still kind of just talking like modern people with like a, you know, old timey dialogue skin.
Which, to be fair, that's what the old-timey Japanese sounds like for in video games.
True enough, but in this case, like, it felt worse because it wasn't per se how, what they were, like, the words they were saying, but the attitudes they had that felt wrong to me. Like, it just, like, you meet up with someone that Jean has met before, and they start doing, like, quips like a modern buddy movie. And that doesn't feel right. That feels off. And so I just didn't gel with it. And, like, the underlying gameplay was good, but it felt sort of like just... It felt like nothing so much as, oh, someone else made Assassin's Creed this year.
Yeah, huge emphasis on stealth and all that.
Like, obviously a huge emphasis on stealth, but just, like, it felt like kind of an old open world game. Like, there's a lot of towers.
Yeah, that is how I felt. Just going through the tutorial, it was like, oh, this kind of feels like something that could have come out 5 or 10 years ago. Yeah. That is how I kind of felt. It just felt like an older open world template. Certainly.
Fireminer asking, by your standard, can only a Japanese developer make an actually period correct Jidaigeki game? I don't think so. I just don't think that that's the mark they hit. I think it's totally possible. I haven't seen whether Yotei attempted to course correct or not, but
I'd say it's possible, but at the same time, the Japanese studios have a leg up just because most of their staff will have had to sit through classical history class in Japanese high school.
I think what ultimately hurt this wasn't even the, like, the history aspect. It was just that, like, they were still trying to make it palatable to, like, a middle of the road open world game, and that's two masters to serve. But I don't know. Maybe I'm not being fair.
Yeah, throw another question in there. Like, how period correct is
yeah,
that?
How it period correct is Tenzan or Way of the Samurai? The answer is not terribly, but they're not period correct in different ways. And especially Tsushima feels much more like it's trying to be period correct.
And that may be actually more of the issue is if a game is period but not really trying or trying to be silly about it, you don't notice the issues as much.
Yeah, it doesn't... The issue comes in from the clash of the attempts at period accuracy that are clashing with the places they couldn't manage it, which end up being more in, like, how, like, story and dialogue are presented, whereas, like, the actual... When you look at something like fucking Way of the Samurai, and you've got, like, fucking, like, evil foreign lady Mega Melons or whatever, you're like, okay, yeah, you're just shitposting at this point. If you think I'm joking, I'm not.
Oh, I'm sure that you were not joking, because that sounds appropriate, but, realistic.
Yeah, it's because her name is Melinda DeCameron.
Mm-hmm.
You can probably guess what that looks like when it's written out in katakana.
Meron de, yeah.
DeCameron.
Yeah.
But yeah, like that one, like Way of the Samurai immediately positions itself as a shitpost. See, I've been into watching people on YouTube backpacking using decades-old travel guides. It makes me appreciate more the flaws of things, not just what create characters, they're also the best witnesses to the passage of time. Just because something is imperfect or even mundane doesn't mean it's unmemorable. Personally, think Yotei's visual director gets that somewhat. I'm interested because I think the world of Tsushima was the part that I liked the most. Like, it was when the dialogue came in that I kind of got taken out of it. But, like, the actual look was extremely good. The thing with ultra-realistic graphics is not just how little it leaves to the imagination, but also it's too perfect. Imagine a field of flowers in real life. No matter how beautiful it is, you'll always find a discolored flower. Perfection is special because imperfection is the norm, and conversely, ultra-realistic graphics are unreal. That said, how many games are designed to elevate the imperfection to make it more memorable? Not just talking about graphics, but also about sound, scripting, etc. That's a tough one. Like, I think that a lot of games ended up doing this unintentionally back in the day, just because you kind of had to pick your battles.
Yeah.
But whenever I think about this, like, I think about this a lot because I think of a very silly line in Metal Gear that ultimately encapsulates this, which is when Snake is asking Otacon about how he can destroy Metal Gear Rex. Otacon is like, oh yeah, if you do, if you hit this one part, there's not really much shielding on there. Like, I did that on purpose because, like, it needed some kind of imperfection. I like to think of it as character flaw. People just aren't complete without a character flaw. And I think that there's something to be said for that in almost anything. Like, the mind rejects and reels at something that is too correct, too perfect, too, like, your mind looks for something that breaks the perfection of the image. And I think that I think that you have a very good point about how important that is. You know, like, if everything is this perfect picturesque, then there's nothing of interest in it because it's all going to look like that. Those little things that are wrong help make the place, especially if you're shooting for realistic, they make the place feel more real. I remember, I bring up these videos all the time because I think they're useful and insightful. Mark Dara, who once upon a time worked at BioWare, talked a bit about the reliance on reused assets in Dragon Age 2 and how one of the problems that the game has is that there is that the main cave asset that you keep going back and forth to has areas that are too specific. They are too obvious. They are too picturesque. So your brain is constantly drawn to this, the same goddamn cave again. I can tell because there's always that corona of light on that one specific patch of grass. Like, it's too memorable. It's too perfect. Like, if they were going to have to reuse this cave so many times, it needed to be less memorable. I'm trying to think of situations where something clearly was played down in order to avoid that sense of perfection. Tough. Yeah, I don't know if I can think of any specifics, although I'm certain that it happens for a multitude of reasons, but I do think you're onto something very specific and very correct, that, like, you know, you need those contrasts, those places that aren't, those light imperfections or those places that aren't as picturesque, because it makes those perfect areas stand out and it doesn't feel as artificial. If there's just one place that looks perfect and serene, then if every place looks perfect and serene, the mind reels when it sees that kind of thing. But we might have to come back to that if I can think of any, but my throat is dying, so we might have to close down soon. Tell me what I can read instead of talking.
Oh, well, there's a lot of stuff out there, you know, and some of it's mine, and I mean, obviously you can enjoy whatever you want, but I would really prefer you enjoy some of mine stuff, please. It'd be nice. So, just as an example, Princesses of the Pizza Parlor on Kindle and Kindle Unlimited. Now long enough that, with enough pages on Kindle Unlimited, that if you read it straight through, you will end up costing Amazon money. Go for that.
Enjoy that.
Yeah. Yeah. That should not be the marketing item that it is, but it is. Okay. So yeah, so 13 episodes, 5 side stories, 1 really long paralogue, and I'm aiming to finish up the main story arc by the end of this year. Hopefully get it out all available to read next spring. Just because I've got too many random projects around here. And then also there is Vainglorious, Long as the Night, a lit RPG that's one part old B-monster movie and one part Metroidvania and one part I'm just having fun writing this. yep. Also, probably made it impossible to properly do an audiobook of it, just because one of the B movie concepts that went into the game world of this story happens to have been a late 80s Japanese tokusatsu movie that never got a proper translation and barely got subtitles. So anytime the heroine is in that particular part of the story, she has no idea what anybody is saying. Is nothing's translated. And I had far too much fun with this. It's one of the few perks of actually doing independent publishing is you can just do whatever and pray that it works. But yeah, so please check that out. That's Vainglorious, Long as the Night by Michael Yarimizu, Yarimizu. Alongside that, we also have Tanuki is a Teapot, my collection of Japanese animal folktales. Again, because I could. Illustrations by myself, again, because I could. I have to keep telling myself this now. And so you have a mermaid series on Royal Road as well, again under the same name. So just all sorts of things going on. Hopefully more to come next year. Hopefully there's all sorts of interesting issues with at least one of the projects that I hope to publish soon. More on that another time, maybe. Anyway, I've probably rambled on too much. So again, that's Michael Yarimizu, Yarimizu, on Kindle and Kindle Unlimited. And also with a odd little romanticy under Michael Spearwater, Spearwater. Again, you know the refrain, because I could. So, have fun, check it out. See you later.
Mm-hmm. Joe, where can we find you?
Currently, I am a streamer for twitch.tv/rpgamer, which you might be watching right now. And I've been doing live streams on Tuesday and Thursday nights, usually starting around 9 or 10 p.m. And then I go till like 11 or 12 or whenever I feel like, because no one's after me. So they did send me a free copy of Pokemon Legends EA. Thanks again to Paws and RPGamer and everybody. And so I streamed that on Thursday night and played about the first 2 hours of the game. And I love the game. We already talked about it. We don't have to talk about it again. But I love the game so far. The stream went pretty well. I think I had 9 or 10 viewers and a couple of chatters. So that was nice. Yeah, so consider tuning into that on RP Gamer, and I'll just be streaming that. And I'm taking a break from Rune Factory. I think maybe I'll try to finish it on my own time and just focus on Pokemon for streaming purposes. Also, as part of October, I do Spooky Hallow Stream. So I have been doing streams on my own Twitch channel. That's twitch.tv/smokeandjoegamer. So I did do a video for Little Nightmares 3, which I ended up beating already. And then I decided to just try to have some fun with the PS5 version of Resident Evil 2, you know, because they added the classics and I got it for free, because I bought it on PS3 years ago. So I decided to just do the arranged game, and I'm just, the goal is I can only use the submachine gun and I have to kill every zombie. So I streamed that the other night. I had some fun. I don't know if I got any viewers, but whatever. I also have a YouTube channel, Smoke and Joe Gamer, where I have a bunch of videos there as well. So I actually did a playthrough of the Little Nightmares 3 demo, which is the first like 2 hours of the game or so, or first half an hour of the game. So yeah, I got a whole bunch of videos there. And then also I'm on the RP Gamer Discord server, so you can chat with me on there. We have some fun on there with all the various channels. And then also make sure you tune in to Extra Life. So November 8th on Saturday, RP Gamer is going to have people streaming all day long. I should be doing a 2-hour stream. They're going to let me just play Tetris, so I'm going to do that. And stay tuned for that too, because we're talking about trying to come up with different donation incentives. So, you know, you can help the, I guess, Extra Life helps like kids with cancer and stuff. So, yeah. So we're going to have different incentives. Like, I think Hairfrog is going to do one where you can decide which horrible European janky game he has to play next. I think Sperombre was talking about
time to shine.
Yeah, I think Sperombre was saying something about doing Heroes of Might and Magic games at some point. There was some talk of people. It's been decided that there will be no incentives regarding like people taking clothes off or putting clothes on or anything
that's
like that.
That's probably wise.
Yeah, that's a good idea. These are PG-13 streams after all. So
shit.
What?
Nothing.
Okay.
Carry on.
So, yeah, that's it. We're looking at that. So, yeah, definitely tune in to my channel, RP Gamer channel. And you can join the Discord server, I think, as long as you're not weird. Although there are some certified weirdos on there, and we get along pretty well.
I mean, you're on there.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know, but some person posted some weird thing the other day and then was calling for other people to be banned. And don't do that. That's all I'm going to say. Just don't do that.
Don't start shit.
Yeah.
He claimed he was trying to test the channel to see if it was cool enough, chill enough for him to stay. Like, seriously, dude?
Yeah.
It was just a social experiment, I scream.
And you can also follow all of us on Blue Sky if that was something you were inclined to do. I'm on there way too much, just staring and lurking. And so you can give any of us a follow on Blue Sky if you wanted to.
I should post sometimes.
Yeah.
Let's see. You can also ask us questions, as dear friend Fireminer did. Thank you, Fireminer. We'll try to be on top of questions more over the next few weeks.
We did good today, though.
Yeah, we did. We did mostly keep on top.
Because the past few episodes, me and Wheels were just really going on and on about Hades 2, and we both finished the game, and now we can answer more questions as a result.
Yeah, we're gonna try to keep that as a trend over the next little while until we inevitably lose our minds or whatever. But for now, you can ask us questions by going to twitch.tv/rpgamer at the appropriate time, which is typically around 8:30 p.m. Pacific, 11:30 p.m. Eastern on Mondays. You can also watch our sister show, Shenanigans, which is more like 9 p.m. to midnight, 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight Eastern on Sundays, going into Monday. But you can also ask us questions by joining the RP Gamer Discord, which requires you to simply go to the community tab of RP Gamer, and there will be an invite there. It's a lovely community, whether you want to ask us questions or not, but the podcast section is always open for your questions. You can also ask us questions by placing comments underneath this very episode on rpgamer.com. Don't send us comments through like iTunes or iTunes review or... is that even what they call it now? Apple Podcast Review? Whatever. Don't send us review questions. That's not going to happen. Smoke signals, unlikely. Don't try it. But otherwise, I think that wraps it up for us. So see ya, Space Cowboy.
See ya.
See ya.